Wood et al. Versus Martin. Yama A. Shansab, Appellant's Counsel. Thomas W. Repzinski, Alyssa Davies, Appellee's Counsel. Mr. Shansab, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Repzinski, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I am.
Chief Justice Lemons, were you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Goodwin, were you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Mims, were you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, were you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, were you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, were you able to hear me and counsel? Justice McCullough?
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay, thank you. Justice Chafin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, the counsel are present and ready to argue.
Mr. Shansab, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to the court. My name is Yama Shansab. I represent the appellants Cheryl Wood, Thomas Wood, Timothy Wood, and Mark Klopfenstein. If I may, I would like to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time.
All right.
May it please the court, a search of the Virginia Code returned only one result for the phrase, quote, in no case whatsoever, end quote. And that is found in Code Section 38.2-3122B. That is apparently how rarely a statute employs such a strict term here to bar other legal process by any creditor of an insured from reaching a protected insurance item, including the life insurance proceeds at issue in this case. Ms. Martin, who could have sought but did not procure an assignment of the insured's life insurance policy, brought a suit based on her amended property settlement agreement and divorce order, relying on legal process to carry out affirmative equitable relief, namely partial nullification of a beneficiary designation that granted her additional consequential legal relief, an award of the protected insurance item in contravention of Section 38.2-3122B's exemption. The result below also ignored the actual terms of Ms. Martin's contract, which contains an express default provision in paragraph 10E, that's the joint appendix at 139, and provides an entirely different remedy in the event of either party's noncompliance at death, a charge against the counterparty's estate. This case, decided on stipulated facts, presents two questions about Section 38.2-3122 and one about an operative contract's express noncompliance provision. First, is there something in Code Section 38.2-3122B that excludes from its exemption a creditor's lawsuit seeking a protected insurance item if the suit is based on an amended property settlement agreement and divorce order? The answer to that question is no. Rather, Section 38.2-3122B, as written, does not carve out any exception for the creditor of an insured who is armed with a property settlement agreement. And in this sense, the case is similar to the claims adjudicated by this court in Crawford versus Haddock under the VRS Group Life Insurance Statute, Section 51.1-510, which was later amended in 2008 to recognize child and spousal support obligations as exclusions from the exemption. The second question about the statute is, does the phrase any creditor in Code Section 38.2-3122, which lacks a technical definition and is not ambiguous, does it depend on a commercial creditor definition applied by the trial court as found in Code Section 6.2-500 of Virginia's Equal Credit Opportunities Act, or for that matter, some other definition to be plucked from some other part of the code as urged by Ms. Martin? The answer to that question is also no. If the General Assembly had wanted us to graft a commercial creditor definition into the text, it could have done so, but it did not, leaving the term to be used in its ordinary sense. Now, without a special definition, the phrase any creditor includes Ms. Martin, a creditor seeking to enforce a contract obligation and who has acknowledged repeatedly as qualifying as a creditor of the insured in this general sense. And that's Ms. Martin's brief at 10, 25, and 28. Also in the joint appendix at 237 lines 15 through 17 of the transcript. Now, the ruling below based on Ms. Martin's amended property settlement agreement, also ignored her contract's express default provision in the event of a party's noncompliance or death with its insurance requirements. And the ruling implicitly expanded the contract's terms in a manner that the contract's express words do not support. First, the agreement does not contain language that its express default provision in paragraph 10E, which is at the Joint Appendix 139, is intended to be an additional or supplemental remedy. Second, it addresses precisely what happens in the event of either party's noncompliance for any or no reason with the agreement's insurance requirements. And third, there is no language of optionality, that is, there is no language that the provision may be disregarded. The arguments by Ms. Martin may advocate for an amendment of Code Section 38.231.22, but as constituted, the statute bars Ms. Martin's lawsuit because even if we were to ignore her contract's express default provision, her relief as a creditor seeking to enforce her amended property settlement agreement and divorce order requires other legal process to carry out the equitable relief to reach the protected insurance item. And that equitable and consequential legal relief is barred by what Ms. Martin recognizes on page 28 of her brief as the claim preclusive effect of the exemption. We respectfully ask this court to reverse the ruling below and enter final judgment for the appellants. I'll reserve the balance of my time if I may.
You have 10 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas Repsinski for appellee Tracy Martin. Your Honors, Ms. Martin is before the court as an aggrieved beneficiary of an insurance policy. The only beneficiary legally designated to receive the policy proceeds interpleaded and being held by the circuit court. Ms. Martin didn't come before the court as a creditor executing on a judgment or seeking to collect unpaid debts, but as the ex-spouse of a bitter, suicidal ex-spouse who, after having been let out of jail for contempt in June 2017 relating to the divorce order, properly designated Ms. Martin to satisfy the court, only later to kill himself publicly and gruesomely several months later, but not before contemptuously thumbing his nose at the court and at Ms. Martin by attempting to undesignate her in violation of the court order. The trial court's disgust at the decedent's behavior was apparent, and it is understandable that the trial court said, quote, "I reject the argument that Section 38.231.22 has any bearing whatsoever on this case." The trial court's use of the definition of creditor, which came or seems to come from seemingly nowhere elsewhere in the code, defies whether Ms. Martin is a creditor at all, because by any definition of creditor, it is immaterial to the proper outcome of this case, which is why a ruling which ultimately resulted in the non-application or the non-preclusive effects of 38.2-3122 is not one which justifies reversal. In fact, the declaratory action and relief sought by Ms. Martin is not prohibited at all by this statute. As a proceeding not contemplated or precluded by the statute, the declaratory judgment relief sought by Ms. Martin is that of a properly designated insurance policy beneficiary, potentially aggrieved by the bitterly angry ex-spouse, but to recognize that to which she is already entitled, as distinct from prohibited actions of a creditor seeking to create rights in assets to or in which one did not already have a recognized right.
Kelsey, may I ask you this question? In the language of subsection B, execution, attachment, garnishment, or other legal process in favor of any creditor, that reads to me as if there is the capability of some viable action by the underlying claimant against the insurance company. And therefore, you can attach or garnish that claim because that claim is owed by the insurance company to the insured, and therefore it's barred to the alleged creditor of the insured. But in this instance, there is no garnishment or attachment or execution, and there's no underlying debt privity that would authorize that kind of process. So my question is, what does legal process mean outside of a debtor, creditor, commercial context?
Outside of a commercial context, it is conceivable that it simply refers to any debt being owed. Your Honor's point is well taken, but to the extent that the series of procedures that are described, the execution, the attachment, the garnishment, are all from the context of an aggrieved creditor. These are all the other legal process in favor of the creditor. It's why a constructive trust approach might be deemed to be such other legal process. It's not, however, a process that would incorporate, or a list of processes that would incorporate something like a declaratory judgment action, where it is simply one who already is deemed by a consensual court order, the divorce order in this case, to have a right, the right to the proceeds, and is merely seeking to have that right recognized. The situations that are described in Section B of a creditor are those where a creditor is seeking to create a right, to establish a new right, if you will, in the proceeds of the insurance policy that don't already exist.
Right. Actually, that's what I was getting at. In a normal garnishment situation, the garnishee, the bank, the insurance company, the whomever, can say to the garnisher, well, I don't know about you, but I don't owe any money to your debtor, and your debtor can't sue me, therefore you can't garnish me. So that's, I wonder if that's how to understand the expression other legal process, because if that's true, that's not at all the situation. Well, the statute doesn't even apply at all to these kind of situations.
Well, that's precisely our point, and has been our point since the very beginning, Your Honor, is this is an insurance statute designed to protect the beneficiaries. And it's important, I think, here to recognize, as we noted in our brief, in a footnote on page 25, Section 38.2-3125 specifically addresses what this statute is intended or not intended to do. And that statute, it notes, it is a that 3122 is intended strictly to confer additional rights, privileges, and benefits upon beneficiaries and assignees of policies. And then it goes on to say quite clearly, no beneficiary or assignee shall by reason of these sections be divested or deprived of or prohibited from exercising or enjoying any right, privilege, or benefit they would otherwise have. So it is clear that it is not intended to work against a beneficiary, especially where, as we've noted, Ms. Martin is one of the defined protected class. If in fact this was a creditor of Ms. Martin's, she would be able to rely on this same statute, because under the same Section B, where the court has noted the definition of any creditor and question the other legal process language, it is also true that under subsection 2, Ms. Martin is one of the persons who can, may, or will receive the benefit of the of a protected insurance item, and any other person, as any other person dependent on the insurance. I would posit to the court that where, as here, there is specific language defining the individual, the plaintiff, the appellee in this case, Ms. Martin, as one of the protected class of the statute. And it is only through a general definition of creditor. Subsection C goes on to suggest that even if this were a situation where Ms. Martin might be held to be a creditor, as a creditor with an assignment, she would be excluded from the application of the statute regardless. So when you couple both the initial point that this is not a process where interpleaded funds are before the court and is merely a question of having the court recognize them as being that those of Ms. Martin, not a creditor seeking to establish some new right in those proceeds, with as well the language in 38.2-3125, which specifically would exclude any application of 3122 against Ms. Martin under these circumstances where she was a consensually court-ordered beneficiary of these proceeds, with then finally subsection C, which says if you want to go ahead and treat her as a creditor, it is as a creditor with a written assignment, she is carved out from any application of subsection B in any event. And that, of course, begs the question.
Stealthy again, one last question along these lines. Why isn't your real theory simply a contract theory against the estate of the decedent? Because these other beneficiaries of the life insurance policy, they claim a contractual right as well against the insurer. Why does your claim have some sort of specific attachment to these exact dollars in the hands of the insurance company as opposed to simply an unliquidated claim against the decedent's estate?
Your Honor, Ms. Martin has both. However, the estate itself has not been opened. There is no known assets. There is no knowledge of what, if any, ability there may be to recover. And to the extent Section 10 of the addendum of the amended PSA, the property settlement agreement referenced by opposing counsel, to the extent Ms. Martin bargained for the ability to go to the estate, it was only, and it only makes sense, that she would only be looking to go there if, in fact, she was not able to be made whole by the proceeds of the policy itself. First,
right, I follow that, but the question I'm asking is a little more fundamental. If somebody took out a life insurance on me and we had a contract that they do that and they breach the contract and they don't take a life insurance out on me like they promised to and they put you as the beneficiary, I wouldn't be able to sue the insurance company for that money. I wouldn't be able to do anything to the insurance company. I have no relationship with them. I could sue you. I could sue whoever made the promise and breached it. But you would still get the money in the insurance policy. I wouldn't get it. I'd just have to get it from whoever breached the contract. Why is that any different from your situation?
The breach of contract claim exists, but what is different here is the ability to recognize in the proceeds where they exist here on a policy that was in fact maintained and was in fact paid for. And I will go a step further, not unique to this case, but as a differentiating fact from some of the other ones, the individual, the decedent, Mr. Wood, actually named and properly designated in June 2017, as stipulated to by the parties, my client, Ms. Martin, as the designee of this policy. And from that moment, where he had contractually committed to designate her in an unencumbered 50% interest of this policy, and that's all we're talking about here, by the way, the proceeds that are before the court are only the 50% not otherwise already paid out, where he had not only contractually agreed to do it, but then in fact did, in compliance with that consensual court order, follow through on that obligation. From that moment, she took on, Ms. Martin took on the rights that he had had in, that were pertinent to his rights in those, in the ability to designate. So he designated her an unencumbered interest by virtue of the court order that he had committed himself to doing. And in so doing, he no longer had a right to redesignate. It's like selling the Brooklyn Bridge and issuing a deed. We all have long recognized stereotypically that that deed is no more a functioning conveyance document than it would be here. So to look to the proceeds of the policy, to where the policy proceeds exist, we don't need to already say they've been paid out and bring them back. We went to the place where they said, look, those are our proceeds. Those were designated for me. I have a specific interest, an assignment, if you will, a written assignment in my documents, in my property settlement agreement, and in my court order. What is a written assignment in Virginia since the late 1900s? A transfer by one to another of any property, real or personal, or of any estate or right therein. And it was a transfer of a present right, divesting the assignor of all control over that which is assigned. And that all control part is key. Did he have the ability to fill out another form and submit it to the insurance company? Yes, he did. But he had no more ability to reassign, to redesignate that which he had already completed through his June 2017 designation. So I believe, and I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. If not, I would offer an opportunity to follow up now. But I believe that addresses the concern. I hope it does.
So what do we say to the beneficiaries of the policy who have a contractual right under the policy, which is a separate contract?
The only right those beneficiaries have are that of a gratuitous beneficiary. It was a gift. There is no evidence before the court. I see my time has expired. May I conclude the response to the question?
The question is pending. You may answer it.
Thank you, Your Honor. The only thing they have is the gift that was offered to them by the decedent, who did so in a manner in violation of the court order and therefore a void act, such that whatever rights those individuals are claiming contractually, they are claiming only by virtue of a void act ab initio. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justice Lyon, Chief Justice Lyon. I'd like to address a couple of the points that were brought up with Mr. Rapsinski. One point was that the phrase in the statute, which talks about execution, attachment, garnishment, or other legal process, might not apply. Of course, the phrase is very similar to the phrase that was employed in the VRS setting in the Haddock or Crawford versus Haddock case. In that case, the statute talked about levy, garnishment, or other legal process. And I believe Ms. Martin's counsel has conceded that a constructive trust could constitute such other legal process. Certainly, my clients who have had a summons and a complaint served against them that is based on a contract obligation and have been divested of $750,000 of the proceeds, the protected insurance item, would believe that that is other legal process by a creditor. And Ms. Martin's brief on that issue at page 10, she says that Ms. Martin is one to whom Mr. Wood owed a financial obligation at the time of his death and is therefore a creditor of Mr. Wood in this general sense of the term. She does not come to the court as a beneficiary. She comes to the court at JA Joint Appendix page 9, paragraph 45 of her suit, as a claimant seeking to enforce her amended property settlement agreement and divorce order. So she has brought other legal process, and she comes to the court as someone looking to enforce her contract claim. There's also the suggestion in the briefs, and it was raised again by Ms. Martin in argument today, that Section 38.231.25 somehow entirely negates the rights of the appellants. 38.231.25 simply is a declaration that the statutes give additional rights to beneficiaries and assignees, neither of which Ms. Martin would qualify as being. There's a reference in the brief, and it was raised again just now in argument, that Ms. Martin is part of or a member of a protected class under the statute. But when we look at the statute, the question of whether Ms. Martin is a member of the protected class, and I believe it's raised in the context of subsection B2, because there's a claim that she is a person who's dependent on the insured. She is, of course, the creditor of the insured. The appellants are not the creditors of Ms. Martin. So although Ms. Martin did not develop any facts in the joint stipulation or in her statement of facts, her brief at pages 5 to 8, that she is a dependent, her status as a dependent would be completely irrelevant because the appellants are not Ms. Martin's creditors under that statute. I'd like to address very briefly this question about the assignment. Of course, if Ms. Martin had procured an assignment, we would not be here. The General Assembly statutes contemplate that if she had obtained an assignment, this exemption could not be interposed as a defense. And to deem the writings that she points to, Ms. Martin points to, the property settlement agreement and the divorce order, as an equitable assignment requires a grant of equitable relief through other legal process, again, contravening the exemption in the statute. But beyond that, there was no absolute, unconditional, and irrevocable transfer to Ms. Martin under the contract, which on page 138 in paragraph 10A of the record of the appendix contemplates that there could even be a future comparable policy that could be used to substitute for the policy that was in place at the time. So the PSA created an executory contract obligation, not a present transfer of existing rights. In fact, Ms. Wood's ownership required future agreement, and that did not materialize. And Ms. Martin acknowledged that Mr. Wood maintained a right of control. She just belatedly disputes the extent of that control. And the argument is also not consistent for an assignment with a case law on assignments. And we cited the Kelly Healthcare case in our reply brief at 10, which reflects that the retained rights here, incidents of ownership of the policy, are inconsistent with an assignment. And that's all I have, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.